Hello, I'm Anna Maria Weldon, and I'll be reading my essay Threshold Country, winner of the inaugural Nature Conservancy Australia's Nature Writing Prize. Threshold Country, first published in Indigo Journal, has been recorded by Lee Kennedy. The full text version is available online at the Nature Conservancy's website. It provides endnotes with full references to organisations and individuals whose work I mention or quote from. Here, then, is Threshold Country, which begins with lines from a poem about leaving the Maltese Islands where I was born and finding Mandurah. I'm drawn to country between wetlands and sea, sand over limestone, like the shore where I left my other skin, before I became estuarine, fresh water on brine. Mandurah is country inscribed with the passage of water, sweet and salt, in drought or inundation, above ground, underground. Its tidal flow inland from the West Australian coast, through the Dawesville Channel, flushes Peel Inlet and Harvey Estuary, where the Serpentine Murray and Harvey Rivers return to the ocean. The Peel-Harvey region is shaped by water's restless cursive, its tidal narrations of exile and arrival. Only at Yalgarup Lakes does water lie pooled and tideless, trapped between dunes, dreaming of the nearby sea it came from long ago. The city of Mandurah is one of Australia's fastest-growing regional centres. Transformed over the past 30 years, some of the fishing village ambience many remember from modest family holidays is now overshadowed by the high-rise real estate typical of baby boomers' sea change nirvanas. Famous for ocean and estuary beaches, boating and fishing, Mandurah is being re-landscaped for tourist complexes and canal homes. But 30 kilometres south of the city, along the old coast road, once its main link to Bunbury, is another world. Yalgarup National Park, a 13,000-hectare coastal strip of limestone and sand dunes, with Ramsar-listed wetlands nestled in their folds. Here, salted scrub and stands of mallee give way to swamp paperbarks and peppermints. Remnant Tuart forest is stranded between land and sea, and timescales meet at the ecotone of Quindalup and Spearwood dunes. Here land holds history the way lakes hold reflections on their surface, the way Lake Clifton holds fossils, shaped like memories, under its skin. This country immerses you, wraps its stories round you, makes you care about them. The curlew sandpipers, which fly here from Siberia, the long-necked turtles who labour to lay their eggs without falling prey to eagles or hawks, the hooded plovers, whose chicks may not hatch, crushed in their sallow sand scrapes on the lake shore, the ancient rock-like mounds, more than 2,000 years old, still growing at Lake Clifton, though they have become remnant fossils in other lakes. They are called thrombolites, lacustrine fossils formed by an accretion of residue from photosynthetic bacteria at their living edge. Like so much else in the wetlands, the active microorganisms are susceptible to alterations in habitat. Their story stands in counterpoint to the scale and pace of urban life and puts Mandurah's recent rapid expansion in perspective. The thrombolites are at least 2,000 years old, and they grow just 0.1 of a millimetre higher each year. This was not the story I planned to write. I was on my way to the southwest's carrion granite country when I came across Yalgarup, and though it felt like love at first sight, I didn't trust my feelings. I was wary of getting involved with another place between land and sea, which evoked too many features of the windswept, salt-encrusted limestone island I had left behind 2 decades earlier. The intervening years were spent trying to free my roots from their Mediterranean bedrock, becoming Australian. But a hidden lake and the precarious living rocks at its heart drew me in, Getting to know them and telling their story has, in unexpected ways, finally taken me across that threshold. The one we don't know is there until the day we feel at home in a place. Our stories of who we are all begin somewhere else. Yalgarup country, too, won't forget where it came from. Its land and water are heavy with the memory of sea. 10 lakes, some brackish and some saline, resulted from alternating ocean levels during this last interglacial period. As they rose and fell, water flowed inland and back. Gradually, as the coastal profile changed, spreading dunes sealed the outlets and trapped residual water. Aerial views of Yalgarup today show these lakes as a brilliant blue chain running north to south in 3 long strands parallel to the coast. But at ground level, even bathed in the famous West Australian light, Yalgarup's bushlands, sand hills and lakes are enigmatic and unfathomable. It's a place of shorelines and sheltered habitats. Each ecotone evokes a litany of names for edge, those margins and thresholds where life must adapt to survive and grow. This is what the Thrombolites have done at Lake Clifton. They look like low circular columns, broken off at the base, edges worn smooth and round by water and wind. Those in deepest water are conical and can reach over a metre in height, with girths to match. When exposed by falling lake levels due to summer evaporation, their surface becomes brittle as dry sponge. Each one is distinct, with cracks and walls on its domed surface as individual as signs of age on a tree or a human face. These remarkable rocks are so friable that before the lake's observation jetty was built, many were crushed by careless visitors. Complex communities of microscopic organisms are housed within their stony structures. They live like orders of anchorites, dependent on symbiotic relationships with each other and the walls growing around them. The minute cyanobacteria are vulnerable to environmental shifts. Their photosynthetic process relies on freshwater springs, which bubble up under them as they grow in the benthic mud and vital clear water. In a fossil removed for geological research, I saw a tiny canal which spring water had left in the core of a thrombolite after thousands of years. The springs on Lake Clifton's eastern shore are rich in calcium carbonate, from which the rocky precipitate, cemented by mucus-like secretions, is derived. Unlike coral, which actively grows its own exoskeleton, thrombolite mounds, also known as microbiolites, are formed by a passive process, including chemical reaction with the brackish water around them. Each alteration to groundwater flow, nutrient concentrations, the lake's salinity, or its rainfall-dependent winter inundation challenges their survival. The thrombolites have lived here for thousands of years due to rare and successful adaptation. In summer, they are almost totally exposed, and in winter, when runoff and rain raise the water level, are fully submerged. Clifton's lake-bound microbiolite reef is the largest in the southern hemisphere, extending over 4 square kilometres. Now, its viability is threatened by encroaching development. Often confused with stromatolites, thrombolites have clotted internal structures, whereas stromatolites are layered. While these internal architectures are significant to geologists and scientists, as a writer on my first visit, it was the striking pattern they made along the shoreline which caught my attention. Summer was ending, and the waters had receded, exposing the reef. As far as I could see, for kilometres north and south along the edge of the Blue Lake, thousands of bone-white stones were arrayed. I had never seen a landscape like it. My first impression was of a traditional Aboriginal dot painting and its encoded message. It was as though the thrombolites were forming sentences strung from words of a lost dialect, I tried to listen, wanting to understand, but heard only the rhythmic lap of water against the pylons, a soughing wind in the sedges. Residues of that first encounter have stayed with me. Studying the thrombolites has not dispelled a sense of their eloquent mystery. Even now, when the fossils closest to the observation jetty have become so familiar that I recognize each one's distinct markings, that memory lingers like a half-lost language, forgotten for lifetimes. It is not forgotten by the Binjareb Nyunga, this land's first people. They know that the thrombolites, which they call Wogul Nuruk, are eggs laid at Yalgarup in the dreamtime by the female creation serpent as she travelled south from the Swan River. I was told this story by George Wally, a local leader and cultural teacher. George's help has been indispensable. This is his country, and I acknowledge his people as its first owners. I write of Yalgarup with respect for their tradition. Learning this landscape like a second language, I found it vital to have guidance from those closest to it, threshold guardians who have opened the way. Despite a very active indigenous cultural presence in Mandurah, casual visitors do not find Yalgarup's heart so accessible. The park is not dramatic in quite the manner hurried tourists expect. Its wildlife is recondite, seasonal or nocturnal. The low-profile terrain, impenetrable bush and scrub-covered dunes are, in my experience at least, more likely to reveal their intricacies to those who return often, inclined to slip inside the quiet. With just a few areas around the national park available for day use or camping, it's not overtly recreational unless you are drawn to isolated tracks and meditative stretches of water. You have to climb up a ridge or steep park lookout to catch other views. Between dunes, you can see only as far as the nearest row of sandhills. In dense bush, only the trees and grasses of a single thicket. Through a lakeside tracks, fringing trees, pieces of aqua water, an unmade jigsaw puzzle. But to me, the lakes are a book of hours in a library of dunes with aquifers for archives. One story floats over another. These wetlands are a palimpsest of water writing, some layers visible, others unseen. No two lakes at Yalgarup share the same chemistry. Each has its own distinct setting, flora and fauna. Elongated Lake Preston is closest to the coast. Behind the next ridge, lakes are grouped like little islands of an archipelago. Travelling north to south, these are Swan Pond, Duck Pond, Boundary Lake, Lake Pollard, Martin's Tank Lake, Lake Yalgarup, Lake Hayward and Newnham Lake. Nearest to the old coast road is Lake Clifton, over 20 kilometres long. Its lake bed, inscribed with histories, lies silent and unread. The thrombolites are not the only memories it keeps under its surface. There is knowledge of early Binjareb fishing traditions, the wounds of invasion, of exploration and massacre, long scars left by the marl miners who took its sand and mud to seal the roads of Perth, splinters of a mast, the remnants of a tragic afternoon in 1886, when the Heron children's sailing boat capsized and its mast stuck fast in benthic mud. Only two of the four siblings on board eventually made it back to shore. Every Australian landscape that matters has its lost children, the voices of myth and story whisper. But I suspect Yalgarup has foundlings too. I spent so much time there just listening and watching, like a child being told stories. What is it that intrigued me from the beginning? Perhaps I've never grown out of my childhood attraction to strangeness. When I first saw this country, despite all that water, it seemed calcified, cryptic and sclerophilous. And yet bore a dangerous resemblance to that other place where I once belonged and left. But there was more. Some notion its significance was at once personal and universal. I felt this terrain had something to tell me, something I needed to learn about loss of country, and recovering a sense of place. To geographer Edward Ralph, the human sense of place is a synesthetic faculty which combines sight, hearing, smell, movement, touch, imagination, purpose, and anticipation. A complex sense, evolved perhaps to compensate for our anatomical deficiencies in perception. We have no compound eyes, nor the ability to see the ultraviolet spectrum, are unable to taste mammals on the wind the way a reptile does with its tongue, or store solar energy through our skin cells, as invertebrates do. We have a limited hearing range. We miss the scent of wind shifts. We are not carried aloft on thermals for a better view. Yet the creatures around us have nuanced ways of seeing, of being seen by each other, and mapping surrounding terrain. We use our imagination instead, our capacity for pattern finding, for making associations and deriving meaning. We navigate by science, but also by story, and it seems to me that at their most authentic, these creative ways of being are a deeper wayfinding than mere mappings. They are our way of singing back country, on the inside as well as the outside, until even such distinctions dissolve. As I began to spend more and more time at Yelgarup, its images and relationships surfaced in the poetry I was writing, shaped its rhythms, and layered the textures. In my poems, these were also my images and relationships, the way events and characters of waking life are absorbed into our dreams without losing their hexity. Rather than imagining country, I was being reimagined through its lens. Late last spring, I was walking with naturalist Laurie Smith, another generous guide, exploring ways to Lake Preston from the seaward side. It was rough ground to cover in the afternoon glare, with only occasional ocean gusts to cool us. I began to regret tackling unfamiliar terrain on such a hot day. Tired but determined to complete the trek, I deliberately concentrated on my breathing, the feel of loose rocks slithering underfoot, and the crunch of dried leaf litter. It's a simple technique to focus the senses, and I find it useful for conserving energy and allaying anxiety. The unsealed access track cut through aged limestone. I was soon acutely conscious of sharp-edged shadows cast by large rocks and ridges with broken shelves and deep sockets. My vision became keener than usual. I noticed a barely trembling acacia branch the moment before a yellow-breasted robin launched into flight. Spun my head to the right and looked down just in time to see the dramatic leap of a hunting monitor at full stretch, airborne limbs wide, reaching for a fallen log where it could become invisible as bark. Only a tail flick betraying its position as it slid to the shelter of tree roots. Then something happened for which I barely have words. As though my feet and the ground were joined. The skeletal structure and deep seams of earth and rock beneath my soles seemed tangible as my own flesh or the aching joints where my cartilage has worn thin. I felt a country of calcium and salt, cloaked in a sand skin cast from crushed shells blown off the coast. Yelgarup's limestone ribs hardened in percolating rain. Its lakes, blue veins of a body made from bone and tears, shaped by breath and flood. When we reached the lake, it was such a homecoming that I cupped its water in my palm and wet my lips in greeting as a sign. It's the way I've taken sweet offerings of prasad, or touch the cooling ash of a sacred fire pit at other places, at other significant moments. The lake clung to my skin like salt residue from a naming ritual. The names for these landscapes are Mandura, from Manjar, meeting place, Pinjara, which means wetlands, Yalgarup, place of swamps. This is a country of dissolving boundaries. The trees and reeds, massed along the many shorelines, lean out and gaze at themselves in looking-glass lakes. Between their beauty and its reflection, between land and water, is a space where stories are timeless and country is alive. The shady Tewat woodlands are filled in with soft peppermint understories, lakes fringed by samphire flats, salt marshes and swamp paperbarks. Wind and glimmer play in shifting shadows and brush strokes of light. But it's not a picture or a framed mirror. This is a place of portals, beckoning the patient visitor to step inside. In September's cool dawn, I lay quietly at the edge of Lake Hayward, under a tangle of low branches, as a family of blue fairy wrens flitted about busily calling to each other, just overhead. In early May, I sat on Lake Clifton's observation jetty at mid-morning, my bare legs dangling over the water, and watched astounded as a black swan flew straight towards me without veering, then passed by so close I heard the wind through its wings. Minutes later, tree martins and welcome swallows, gorged after feeding on newly hatched midge larvae, lined the railings surrounding me, as though I were part of the structure. I knew they had just fed, because the hatching swarms formed dense columns which rose from between the lake's fringing trees in dark spirals, so like smoke that several visitors ran for their cars thinking it was the start of a bushfire. But a drone resembling miniature chainsaws told another story as millions of insects explored the air. Such disturbances are rare. There are many places in Yalgarup notable for their stillness and silence, though they don't have the special presence of thrombolites. Baudrillard could have been describing the wetlands when he wrote, "It is this stillness things dream of. It is this stillness we dream of." At Martin's Tank, for instance, the paper barks grow so close to the shore I can slide to the ground, lean my back against a tree trunk's interleaved softness, then stretch my feet and cool them in the shallows. Each old tree's torso is wrapped in moth-wing layers of papery fibre, bark that hangs down in tissued swatches, forming curled patterns as it peels away. As the folds loosen, they rustle in the wind like leaves of old prayer books. Shadows fall in paint strokes on the hollows between walls. Shafts of sun highlight curves and scrolls. Some trees have a pale peach or pink flush to their bark. Others are salt white, with dramatic charcoal markings, like shading on a sketch. Their branches, outstretched and sinuous, express different moods in changing light. The tree that seems peaceful as a sage, streaming white hair haloed by the midday sun, can become a tortured soul with gesticulating limbs by dusk. Many are clustered in groves, though like the thrombolites, they are individual, gnarled characters I look forward to visiting. When I go to Yalgarup, alone, I never feel lonely. At Lake Preston, where the causeway to Preston Beach divides the waters into north and south lakes, I've watched a single kangaroo sit at the lake's edge at daybreak, gazing across the water. That morning, out on the sandbars, avocets and banded stilts and shell ducks had stopped feeding and were standing perfectly still on their reflections. It was a landscape on the boundary of day and night. Everything paused, waiting for a solstice sun to rise and mark the year's still point. And when it did, all energy seemed focused on that radiant pendulum. As it rose above the tree canopy, warming air lifted the fleecy golden mist which covered the lake. Cleared like breath from glass, it left water polished as an ephemeral mirror, in which birds and trees hung motionless under their doubles. Then all changed again. A breeze ruffled the reflection. Creatures turned back to feeding. And despite this movement, it seemed that the lake held its hypnagogic trance between sleep and dream, where for a moment the world within the world is glimpsed. At Lake Clifton, the Thrombolite's ancient presence creates this same impression, no matter what time of year or day I visit. I'm often reminded of South Australian poet John Shaw Neilson's image of ripples around rocks as thoughts coming out to the edge of a dream. I think of this line from The Crane Is My Neighbour when I see the white-faced heron which haunts a particular stretch of shallows by the boardwalk. A lifelong love of reading has shaped my perceptions. When I found reference to the wayfarer's way of attention, observation, navigation by signs, by memory, by experience, in Beverly Farmer's book, The Bone House, I wondered, by whose memories and by which signs do I navigate this landscape? And where do they meet? In both the cultural and scientific narratives of Yagarup, thrombolites exist at the boundary between the animate and inanimate. Researchers are still inquisitively separating out the various living forms and functions within each microbial community, unraveling and identifying complex relationships which enable organisms to coexist at a density of 3,000 per square meter. It's been established through the Pilbara fossils that reefs like those at Lake Clifton existed 3.5 billion years ago and were widely distributed in the oceans. It is highly probable that a type of cyanobacteria enabled life to flourish on Earth by increasing the atmospheric oxygen to 20 times its original level. And the Binjarup creation story, too, remembers the woggle eggs in the beginning. To me, the thrombolites are akin to Diane James' concept of rocks of deep time, which names the transition I feel when at Lake Clifton, as I move away from what she calls the surface of shallow time. They draw energy up from the springs and down from the sunlit sky of the west coast, transforming it into life for themselves and oxygen for the planet. Semi-submerged for half the year, they survive on seasonal inundations and a delicate balance of lacustrine chemistry. These amniotic waters may become embalming if nutrient levels continue to rise due to agriculture and urban sprawl. Can we learn in time to tread more lightly here? I think as I write of reflections on the lake, plants and birds lying weightless on its polished surface, like perfect offerings to the light they came from. There's only a handful of places left on Earth where thrombolites still live and grow. In their precariousness, they point not only to life's origins, but to that darkening edge which all living things must eventually reach. I think of that time at the end of each day when the black swans fly in low from the south. Necks outstretched, they look like a line of long stitches which night pulls to its far shore, that shore running like a seam through the twilight silk of sky and water. Darkness and light live here in relationships I have yet to understand, but I suspect has to do with the line we trace around its edge. Whenever we draw a heart, the line which defines what we love is the edge we feel so sharply when it is relinquished. Is that the reason why so many of us remain indifferent to country for so long, and why so few can name even the trees in our own streets? In a nation where half of us are migrants or born of a migrant, and so many others are dispossessed of their land, is connection to country perhaps too painful. Knowing the names of trees or birds is not, however, knowledge, and only sometimes is it the beginning of understanding or affection. As the Indian sage Krishnamurti cautioned his followers, naming something is not the same as seeing it. In Roger MacDonald's book, The Tree in Changing Light, there's a chapter about the painter Tom Carment, who painted trees because he was interested in the emotional content of the light around them. Something he said he could no more give a name to than he could give a name to the trees. I have a great deal of empathy with his attitude. But there is a place for practical knowledge which, beyond names and a sense of engagement, demands time and a special kind of attention, especially to know what is no longer there. Walking at Lake Clifton with Galliano Fardan and his wife Nancy, I suspect it also takes love. They share a nuanced relationship to this land, the familiar intimacy of long-time residence. He's a distinguished artist, whose inspiration comes from the landscape, and she's a conservationist, making a difference in her community. They live on Lake Clifton's eastern shore in a house they built themselves over 20 years ago. When they first arrived, there were bandicoots, long-necked turtles, Carnaby's black cockatoos and bubukals. Now, they tell me, there are hardly any. The same is true for black monitors, stilts, bee-eaters, bats and bangara. They rarely see hooded plover, tawny frogmouths, yellow-breasted robins or brown falcons on their land. New species are moving in, though not all of them are welcome. The Faradans have planted thousands of trees, reforesting cleared paddocks, yet only a few hundred seedlings have survived to maturity. The park's tuets are dying. In some areas of the original tuet forest here on the Swan Coast Plain, which is the only part of the world where tuets occur naturally, the mortality rate is 50%. At Yalgarup, many remaining tuets have stark, grey upper branches. Dead wood forks skyward like inverted lightning or broken arms of a ruined clock. As emptying skies and seas return to their original unwritten blue, they are telling us that catalogues of birds and creatures are vanishing. Scientists have now identified the dieback species, Phytophthora multivora. Tuets were thought to be resistant to the pathogen, and nobody really knows why they became susceptible. Is it something we did, or is it a natural cycle? Have we tried to fix things without fully understanding the ecological consequences of our so-called solutions? Galliano wonders if maybe the trees are dying because our activities have become separated from issues of survival. At the Thrombolite Reef, Western scientific knowledge and indigenous wisdom concur. The microbiolites, the Woggle Nuruk, are precious markers of life's origins. And we agree they are threatened by our way of life, though, as with the wider debate on climate change, there's no consensus on what constitutes the danger, what ought to be done about it, or by whom. While we try to reach conclusions about our impact on the thrombolites, they silently mark time at the threshold of living and dying. The immediacy of the threat to their precarious existence, in contrast to the ancient living lineage they represent, is a potent metaphor for our time. But because this landscape has also kept them alive for thousands of years, I think of it as a place of hope. With the help of the Threshold Guardians, Yalgarup has encouraged me to recover my sense of place and shown me how caring for country carries us further, together, than we could go on our own. Like every story at Yalgarup, this one has water running through it, sweet and salt, in drought or inundation, above and underground. I'm estuarine, bicultural by nature and circumstance. Like the freshwater here which seeps from springs and collects deeper down, I've arrived after a long journey. But the salt was always in my veins. I am at home here. The waters of Yalgarup wend their way home through a catchment sprawling over hundreds of kilometres from as far inland as Williams. Runoff soaks the wetland's mudflats and is filtered through its salt marsh reeds. In winter, when rain dilutes a lake's salinity, a thin lens of sweet water rests on the heavier, salty layer. This lacustrine syntax is repeated in the underworld of limestone aquifers. Tree roots reach for the fresh water that floats at the top of the water table. The earth through which all this water flows is folded and layered, so that coming upon a lake or pool here has something mysterious about it, a sense of discovery or revelation. This accords with the belief held by most traditional cultures that life-sustaining water bodies, rivers and wells, fjords, billabongs and brooks, lakes or inlets, have special significance. They are boundaries, and as Martin Heidegger observed, a boundary is not that at which something stops, but that from which something begins its presencing. Thousands of years ago, Yalgarup's traditional Noongar owners, the Binjareb people, founded a culture on this understanding. They learnt it from country, and we can too.